You know, most insects that hitchhike into our homes on Christmas trees don't survive long indoors, but there's an insect pest that threatens evergreens while those evergreens are still standing. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri back with us to talk insects. Phil's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. And as he comes by every so often to talk with us about what's going on with our insects, and I'm glad to have him back today. What bug questions do you have for Phil? Are there some problems with insects or maybe just some questions about them this time of the year? Join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
What's the invasive insect that's after those Michigan trees, and how does it kill fir trees?
Okay, so the critters are called adelgids. In fact, woolly adelgids, because they're funny. Think of them as aphids, and there is one on firs, and honestly, there's another one on hemlock that has been moving this way, and they literally suck the life out of the plant. They are slow-moving in the sense that, you know, we don't have wing forms that go large distances, so that's why these kind of quarantines are a way of trying to keep things localized and not ship infested trees out of infested areas.
So there is that what Michigan's doing, quarantining?
Yeah, they have one county where they are kind of circling the wagons and trying to keep things contained. They had it once, they eliminated it, they thought, but then it's reoccurred. And again, this problem has been coming from the East Coast for quite some time. I remember the woolly adelgid on hemlock has created all kinds of problems in the mountainous areas out there. Now, we don't have a lot of hemlock except in the northern part of the state, and again, so far it has not arrived. But I mean, the argument, it's a matter of time, but it'd be nice to slow it up as much as we could.
Yeah. How do they get here? And you know, if they come, how do they get here? How'd they get to Michigan, for example?
Well, again, you kind of wonder if they were hitchhiking on something. And that's why, you know, most states do have quarantine rules and shipment rules and certification of you're getting stuff from out of state to try to prevent that. But unfortunately, as we know, sometimes things don't get inspected or, you know, circumvent the rules. And so you can only guess, but that one you would, again, suspect that it somehow hitchhiked into the area in the UP.
How visible are they, Phil?
If you look closely, you see this white, almost tiny cotton candy puffs on the tree, whether it's on the needles or the twigs, depending, you know, and the trunk. And so that should catch your attention. But I warn people that there are other native insects that are rather similar that are fuzzy like that. It's just that these two particular species are non-native. Typically, these invasive critters, because they have not evolved here, don't have much in the way of natural enemies. The trees don't have much in the way of defenses, and so they have, unfortunately, more of an impact.
Yeah. So if a landowner sees evidence of these insects, I imagine they should be reporting it.
Oh, definitely. You know, whether you the local DNR forester, you can bring it to the extension office, and they can send it down to PJ to verify. You know, there are places to take in call for people to come in, and especially again, you know, Christmas tree and people and whatnot maybe are a little bit more attuned to the kind of inspections you can get. But anybody that sees something suspicious, even taking a picture to just start out and sort through and send it to somebody who knows is very helpful.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. So there's other bugs or insects that could find their way into our homes on our Christmas trees. Basically, what bugs are those?
Well, again, it turns out either both aphids and there's some little needle midges, gall midges, that I historically would see once in a great while. You know, and you get the tree in the house, you warm it up, and after a couple of days, there's all these little critters going around. Now, the good news, it can't breed indoors. They're not going to hurt anything. In the case of a couple of the aphids, you've got to be a little careful. If you crush them, they can stain things. But, you know, if they've been exposed enough cold weather, they kind of get into a stage, and then bringing them in the house, they honestly think it's spring, and they kind of wake up. And, you know, the vacuum cleaner probably is as good as anything. And if you had to, a little insecticidal soap goes a long way of killing them, because they're soft body creatures and they don't survive. And usually, again, after 3 or 4 days, mm-hmm. things settle down by themselves. So there really isn't much to worry about. But again, when you find little critters coming in your house on plants, people tend to get concerned. So.
Yeah. And I don't know, is there much we can do about avoiding bringing them in with Christmas trees?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, just give it a close look. See if something doesn't look right, then it may indeed, you know, be worth investigating. As I said, the chance of it is extremely, extremely small. And if it does happen, it's nothing other than a nuisance. But, you know, if you can avoid it, so much the better. You know, I would worry again about little white fuzzy things on needles. I also would worry about swelling on needles, because some of these gall midges cause a little bit of a round, almost BB-sized growth, and then they emerge from there. That's how they typically get through the winter. And again, they're really tiny little gnat-like creatures. Don't do anything. But as I said, so if you see something that doesn't look right, maybe look for a different tree.
Yeah. Donald in Bayfield has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Donald.
Hello. Say, about 4 years ago, all my balsam firs started dying.
Okay.
And I don't know why.
Okay. So big trees, small trees?
Big trees, small trees, all of them dead.
Okay. You know, so after extensive stress on trees, I always worry about bark beetles on conifers, because they just are really quite aggressive. But I'm a little nervous with the trees that, I can't rule out it's not a disease. And, you know, typically, you know, once a tree starts to show you, a conifer starts to show you that it's dying, it's often very far down the road. But if you start seeing discoloration or whatnot, it may be worth getting a sample sent in to, the plant disease lab down in Madison, or the insect lab, or you can send it to one side and they'll pass it back and forth if they need to. Another thing you can do just to kind of look is just take a little bit of a knife and slit down the twig and see if you see any discoloration inside. That's usually suggestive of a disease. But I think it takes more digging, because they said if the trees are dying, I expect little holes in the bark. I expect sawdust to come out. Those are the bark beetles. But typically we take a step back and say, why is the tree so stressed that it can't defend itself against these? And that's kind of the way I'm leaning. Now, this year, you know, we had drought stress in the past, but even though we had that little section in of dry weather, this has been an amazing year for moisture. So that should allow trees, if it was drought-related, to strengthen up and start fending off some of the bother. But I think this takes a little bit more digging. Look at the trunk, look at the needles, look at the twigs, see if you can see anything that just doesn't look right.
Yeah, there you go, Don. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Got an insect question? Love to hear from you. Jack in Green Bay emailed to ask how they can reduce or stop fruit flies in their kitchen and living room where they have, flats of wheat growing. Somewhere in the house, kitchen or living room.
Okay, make sure that they're truly regular fruit flies, because I think of fungus gnats when I hear about all kinds of little plants growing. You know, fruit flies in the house have to be breeding in the house, especially at this time of the year. And you associate them with anything that is overly ripe. And what's going on is they lay their eggs there, and the maggots feed on the yeast associated with decay. So there's always that correlation. Now, it can be in recycling cans. It can be in a squash you forgot about down in the basement. I mean, the sources sometimes can be a little hard to find. But fruit flies, usually, if you can hunt down the source, it'll eliminate it. Again, what bothers me with the wheat there is, I said, some of these critters that will breed on organic matter in soil are kind of fruit fly, like a little bit smaller bodied. Another dead giveaway, true fruit flies, not all of them, but one of the most common species have reddish eyes. These other little fungus gnats, you're not going to even be able to see the eyes, but they're definitely not red. So that's one way to tell them apart. And if it's the fungus gnats, it gets a little bit tricky because being in the soil, there are some bacterial insecticides that are really, as far as humans are concerned, a very safe thing to use that you can put in that would kill the maggots. But I wouldn't go that direction unless I was sure. But another thing to do to kind of to figure it out is just root around in the flats a little bit. You should start to see little clear maggots with dark black heads if it indeed is a type of fungus gnat. Fruit fly maggots are more whitish to brown, and you can't really see a defined head on it, although you know, you'd have to go digging into stuff to find them if they were there. So,
thank you very much for calling. I appreciate that email, I should say. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. It's great to have Phil back. Questions again, insect question or maybe an experience you had, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. There are some stored product insects that have gotten into the, well, they've been in the food supply for a while. Stored product insects, what can you tell us about those pests?
Okay, well, they're very dear to my heart because my master's dissertation was chasing those critters around the state. And there's a handful of insects that are pretty much worldwide in distribution that are feed on dried plant material. You know, talk about flour, rice, but we're also talking about spices and other goods that you can have in the house. Dried flour arrangements would fit that. And the frustration, they often come in pet food, even though industry goes to great extremes to prevent it. But then once they get in, they have the capacity to get into other things, get in your cupboards and the like. And they can be quite frustrating. And of course, being a food pest, you can't spray the food. And so usually what you have to go through is a sanitation, throw out what you know is infested. Things that you haven't opened that you're not sure of, you can throw in the freezer for a couple nights, and that would definitely shut down anything that might have found a way into that packaging. It's a good idea for things that you don't use up very often, you know, that take months to get through, is to put in good plastic or screw top jars or something that the critters can't get into. The glued cardboard boxes we've got really don't help us much. And so, as I said, it's something that if you find the problem has gotten in, you got to be careful that they haven't jumped. And you really got to go through kind of a pretty thorough look-see just to make sure. And when I've related on the show before, we had some critters that came in on bird seed. They ended up getting to the cupboard. We threw out some rice and some other things, and I thought we had won the war. But there was this trickling. It was a type of moth called an Indian meal moth. And I kept on seeing maybe one every 4 or 5 days, and it just didn't make any sense. And I was, of course, getting some grief from my wife about not being able to solve the problem. It took literally about 6 months. And what it all traced down to is a bag that I was sure had screws and other things from the hardware store. When I opened it up, it had some vegetable seeds that my father-in-law had given me months before. And the critters had found that, and that was the last remaining source. So as I said, sometimes, you know, if most of these little moths are fluttering around in your bedroom closet, you got something, as I said, an old Christmas wreath or, you know, nuts, they get into that kind of stuff. Even old art objects that, you know, the kids made when they were in kindergarten out of plant material, and you put them away to save to show the kids down the road. They get into something like that, they can feed on that too. So, as I said, once you go through the obvious things, it's best then to start thinking about what some of these crazy items that are plant-based could be the source of the critters.
I mean, I'm sure companies try to keep them out.
Oh, yeah, they go to great extremes, you know, in the plants and the like, and you know, but once they get out of the manufacturing process, you know, sometimes they're around for months, and depending how they are stored, they can become infested that way. Very few of these insects are, quote, native in the sense that you can find outdoors in Wisconsin. But again, any place where food is stored for a period of time, you know, the dust and debris back in the corners can support critters. And they said, in my master's dissertation, I came up with over 100 critters I could find in feed mills that we would classify as stored grain insects.
Phil Belladeri, our guest. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Christina, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. As a person who travels often, this insect is always at the forefront of my mind, but I haven't heard anything lately. Are bed bugs still an issue?
People are more aware of it, and things have generally don't get out of hand, but they are not easy to control because they're resistant to some of the standard treatments and the like. And so it's best to keep your guard up. Safe traveling practices. To be honest, we put our suitcases in the bathtub when we travel because that's a place you likely would not pick them up. You know, if you hear about things, you can throw your clothes in the dryer when you come back to stop it. Leave the suitcase out in the garage for an extended period of time. It's just best to be careful because if indeed you bring them home, it'll take weeks before the numbers get up enough to cause a problem. And as I said, then you're facing a not the easiest to solve problem. And what they're using still to a great degree are heat treatments where they come in and the critters can't survive about 112 degrees. But for somebody to bring in the equipment and the people power and time consumption to do it, you're talking hundreds, if not over $1,000 to do a treatment in a home. And that's staggering as far as cost. And so if you can at all avoid it, as I said, just be a little careful, diligent. It's good to, you can check the headboards, you can check the mattress, especially around the mattress seams. I check the frames around the pitcher. Bed bugs like wood. And so what you'll often see if you've got an infestation is these little black spots, which are their waste spots. And if you see a bunch of that accumulating, it may be from an infestation from before, but at least it would raise my concerns, and I would, speak to the manager and whatnot and probably ask for a different room.
Yeah, absolutely. Christina, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Phil, I don't know if you know Barrett Klein. He's a professor at UW-La Crosse in entomology. He's written a great book called The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. And one of the things he talks about are ants. He mentions ants and says that there's about, they estimate about 20 quadrillion ants in the world, and that'd be about 1.25 billion per person in the world. But what about ants in winter? Are those of that 1.25 billion that are my ants, I guess? How unusual is it to have home infestations of ants during the winter?
Well, the one thing that saves us to some degree is insects being cold-blooded. If it's below 50 degrees, they can't move. So all the outside ants are basically shut down. There are some, though, that can survive indoors, and more often than not always, but they're not native ants. They're ants that don't belong here, but they've adopted. So you see any ants in the house from about the 1st of December till, almost the 1st of April, they're nesting indoors where it's warm. And then you need to hunt it down. It helps to know what kind of ant it is because then you know what they like to eat, which will give you some idea of what kind of baits you might consider using. But it's not normal to see ants indoors, as I said, because the ones outside, it's too cold for them to forage in. Carpenter ants, I could get them any time of the year. Usually they're looking for water, and if they're nesting in the house, they're even nesting where it is away from walls and ceilings. It will be too cold for them to go. As things start to go maybe into late February, early March, the outside walls warm up enough that if that's where the nest source is, you start seeing big black ants crawling around. And as I said, that's always a red flag that they're nesting indoors when you see them at that time of the year. The smaller ants, it gets a little tricky. I mean, we've got pavement ants. There is even some exotic pharaoh ants and whatnot that you can get. But they're really quite unusual. And as I said, usually once you discover it and you do a little homework, you should be able to take care of it. And the secret anytime with ants, if you can find the nest and treat it, you're done. It's just that many times there just is not any obvious signs of what's going on.
Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed us to say it costs very little to determine if you have fruit flies, drain flies, or fungus gnats. He says, put out a coffee mug with a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar and a few drops of dish soap. Fruit flies will be drawn to the vinegar, and the dish soap will break the surface tension, so they'll sink when they try to feed. And drain flies, however, and fungus gnats ignore that sort of thing. So that's one way to tell the difference. What do you think?
Oh, very good test. It's one of the common names for fruit flies are vinegar flies, and they're associated with that overly ripe vinegary smell, which is associated with the yeast. Now, drain flies are critters that often breed the like, they can be frustrating, but they're fuzzy. In fact, some people call them moth flies because they look that way. Fungus gnats, a little trickier. They're kind of like small mosquitoes. And again, most typically they're associated with potting soil, although sometimes, again, when we bring in bulbs and stuff from outside to overwinter, that's a way of bringing little critters like that into the house.
One of the concerns regarding insects has to do, of course, with population decline. And any opinions on that? And what are your thoughts on that? I know in my own case, I'm leaving up vegetation and so forth from the garden rather than, at least the healthy plants so that insects have a place to kind of overwinter. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's so much going on, and a lot of it's alarming. I was just reading recently the discussion about putting monarchs either on the endangered or threatened species list, and because their populations have declined so much in the last 20 years, and that's just an example. This is discussed a lot. There have been a lot of studies to show various declines, and you're pointing at everything from climate change to pesticide use to, again, even the way we farm, getting rid of fence rows and other things that had gave us more of a diversity of plant material, which then would give us more of a diversity of insects. And so, I think we can all try to do our share, but on the bigger picture, it is quite concerning, as I said, because maybe it's my perception, but as a kid, there was a whole lot more critters flying around the streetlights than there are now.
Yeah, for sure. Julie in Northern Greene County emailed wanting to know a little more about the fir tree bug we were talking about at the start of the show. Julie recently planted some balsam fir with existing white pine and spruce. They were hoping to plant a few white fir and a few more balsam. Is this not a good idea? Julie says many of their spruces have succumbed to needle fungus disease, and they've even lost a few of their white pine. And Julie's mantra is diversity, but they are afraid to lose more trees.
No, I think diversity is the direction to go. There is always a potential threat for any tree for something new and exotic to move in. And, you've got to pay attention to soil type and in some of the characteristics that the plants like. And anytime you put a plant in a place that it really doesn't belong, it will be stressed. And as I said, to me, that opens the door for other things. But I would not plant firs. I like firs in particular, both as a Christmas tree and as a tree in general. And I think that is the better way to go. Who's to say? It could be 50 years before this arrives. It could be not as much of a problem in our climate as it has been out east and the like. And so, as I said, in my career, all the invasive critters that came, for the most part, were the worst when they first came, and then they kind of mellowed out and settled down. I think the only major exception to that probably is the emerald ash borer, which really, as far as its impact, you don't see it slowing down. But normally, a lot of these invasives, as they said, we are concerned. We have some educated guesses, but we're not always totally sure what's going to happen down the road when they come. And as I said, for this one in particular, I don't see it moving fast enough, and definitely do not see it as a reason to avoid to plant those plants.
Helen in West Salem will go to you now. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I have a kind of an odd problem. I have a planter right outside my west window, and every year I've had these ants come in, which is fine. They are right there on the floor, and I give them the taro, and they go away. Well, now this year, this spring, they did not come in. And when I went out to plant my geraniums, I got bitten by these ants like you wouldn't believe. Small ants, same kind of ants that would come into the house. And they were, when my arm was sore, and it itched, and it hurt, and whatever. Finally, the welts went away. So what I'm thinking is that with such a mild winter that they didn't need to come in, and so they're out there. And what can I do? Is there something I can insert into the planter so that they don't bite me next year in case we have another mild winter?
Yeah, okay, so they spent the time outside in the planter.
Yeah, and it may or may not be the same ant. There's a lot of ants that look very similar. It's a little suspicious if the ants were in the habit of coming in for food, why they didn't do it again. And there are some ants that don't come in for food. So if you've known this, I guess in the spring when you're moving the soil and just be a little careful, you see any sign of ants, I would treat the soil. And in particular, I think one of the concerns, when you use insecticides, many of the insecticides aren't necessarily good for the roots of plants, and usually it's not the insecticide, it's the carrier. So I often would recommend, if you needed to treat there'd be a lot of plant roots, I would use a dust type of product. Any of the garden dust would be suitable, and just mix it into the soil, and it will take care of the problem quite quickly. And as I said, I don't see an advantage of treating it now. The winter, yeah, it's hard to make a call on that. Although if the critters have been seeming to be there every year, I'm not sure whatever happens with the winter, I would suspect that the ants probably survive. And as I said, I would gear up for taking care of it in the spring before you put in your transplants.
Yeah, Helen, makes sense. Good. Thank you very much for calling. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Sue in Madison emailed to say they have several native viburnums in their yard that have been devastated by the new viburnum beetle over the past two seasons. And Sue's debating whether to try to treat the plants somehow in early spring to reduce the infestations. They may also replace the viburnums with some other type of shrub. What advice do you have there?
Well, her timing is great. It's all about catching it early when things get rock and rolling. And it's interesting, different viburnum species, they're not all susceptible. I've got some Korean spice. They never touch that and the like. A lot of options, a lot of garden insecticides, including some organic things like spinosad, which is a good beetle killer. And again, once it starts to leaf out, you got to mark the calendar because typically what happens with some of this stuff is the insects are well on their way before people think about it. And as I said, if you time it, you know that is a spring critter and get after it. I've noticed the same thing in my walks around the neighborhood. You know, as I said, the people that have the susceptible varieties, like some of the American highbush cranberries and the like, they really have gotten very hard. And I remember that this was just starting to fester as I was retiring. We had one case in Verona that the Department of Ag inspectors picked up, and that stopped. But then all of a sudden, we started seeing a lot of problems in Milwaukee, and it has spread from Waukesha, Milwaukee, into a good portion of the state, and will continue to spread, unfortunately.
Suzanne in Manitowoc emailed to say there are pantry moth pheromone traps that Suzanne has found effective. The best ones are made by Dr. Killigan. So comment there. Also, Suzanne says they have lots of daddy long leg spiders. They're not bothersome, but Suzanne is curious what they're eating.
Okay. As far as the pantry moth, they're great for monitoring, but the problem with the pheromones that they use is they're only catching the males, and you're not catching the females. And so sometimes that's just enough to knock it down. But it's relying it on a control by itself, I don't. As I said, I think it's a great way to see if things are going on. And are used quite commonly in food warehouses and whatnot, as I said, to give them an early warning of what's going on. Now, daddy long legs are technically not a true spider, and they are omnivorous. They feed on various debris and the like, more often dead stuff. So unlike spiders that are conscious predators of other critters, daddy long legs are kind of more likely to feed on dead stuff than they are live stuff and are really not aggressive as far as that goes. And, you know, really more kind of an outside critter, but they do spill in and can kind of hang out for quite some time indoors. But nothing to be concerned about other than, again, most people have a hard time warming up to them. And so I think they get people a little bit more concerned than they should.
Mary emailed to say they occasionally sees silverfish, maybe two or three every 6 to 8 months, on the bathroom floor tiles. Unsure where they're coming from, the nearest wall is shared by Mary's closet, but they've never seen them in there. Wants to know about the habitat, the life cycle, sure. I mean, food choices and that sort of thing of silverfish.
So silverfish and the related fire brats, which are, instead of being silver, are kind of a light brownish color, are critters you normally don't find outdoors. They're found indoors. They feed on starch and other debris. We're a concern for old antique books sometimes feeding on the pages and the like. I think the problem we have in older houses is there are paper sources and other things where the critters can be living in the walls, not thriving because she's not seeing a bunch of them. And the true silverfish tends to like things on the more humid side, so the bathroom is not surprising. Really, typically, I think the basements, because they tend to be humid and like are, and there's, you know, usually something around for them to chew on. And now, back in the day, I remember somebody came up with a starch-based bait for silverfish, and they were just using boric acid as the toxicant. And the idea, if you had a lot of problems, you could put these starch-based baits out there and they'd feed on it and that would do them in. It might take some digging, but that is one potential source. They do respond to any indoor sprays. But the problem, again, is, you know, she's seeing them in the bathroom. But they're not breathing in the bathroom, so spraying the bathroom floor and whatnot, I don't think is going to get you very far. And a question, can you get access to the walls in a way that would make a difference? More likely not, but if you've had any pipe chases or those kind of things, that would give you at least one thing to think of. And as I said, ultimately the bait is kind of a more passive way of trying to wrestle with this. It's interesting. In the home I've been in now for a period of time, I have not seen silverfish, but the previous home I owned, it was kind of a constant nag. And it was interesting because it was an unusual silverfish called a four-line silverfish that we had running around. You know, it had been the first time I'd ever seen it in the house. And again, sometime well before I bought the house, somebody had it, and it was an older house, you know, that had older insulation that had paper backing and the like. And I just assumed they were happy to be in the walls.
Yeah, I had them in an old farmhouse that I lived in many a year ago, and when we were breaking into the walls for something, I found that they were newspapers that were being used as insulation in there. So perfect habitat there.
Yep, and yeah, that's classic. All the food that they need, and as I said, it's subtle enough, and they, you never seem to see places overrun with them. And as I said, I think the main concern, other than just not wanting critters inside, is there are some starch-based things that you might have around that you have to be careful of, because they can cause some damage there.
Yeah, and silverfish, that they're not eating other insects in the home, are they at all? That's the house centipede,
no.
Isn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, no, silverfish are basically, again, just kind of starch-based feeders. You know, there might be some dried plant material, but I really just have not seen a whole lot of problems with that. And it's usually stuff that is left undisturbed for an extended period of time. They're not really fast in doing anything. So.
Well, I was thinking about ladybugs before the show started, because I actually found one in my house this fall, and I thought, how the heck did it even get in? Because I've got a Energy Star home that's tight as a drum. How do they normally get in?
Boy, I think there are ways to weasel around in walls and whatnot. the more tight you got things, the better chance you got. But no matter how good you are, I never something expect to be 100%. As I said, just because watching, you know, the structural weakness of most homes that I find is where your siding meets the foundation. It's often just little spaces and critters like earwigs and what can often squeeze through there, and then who knows where they're going to show up, type of thing. And so sometimes, again, the room that you find is not really the true source of it, unless there's a pattern. You know, if everything keeps on piling into a bathroom, I start to worry about vent fans and those kind of things as being the structural weakness.
Yeah. And Jeff Robbins, our technical director today, was telling me he read a piece on stink bugs, and I hadn't thought about them because a couple of years back I found just one of those in my house, but apparently the article stated that there was an increase, or people were seeing more stink bugs in their homes. Talk about stink bugs.
Yeah. So the one that's causing the problem is an Asian species called the brown marmorated stink bug. It's been in the state for about 10 years, and its claim to fame is just like the Asian lady beetles and the cluster flies and the like, is they look for sheltered sites in the late fall, get into your walls, and then when things warm up, they're crawling around and the like. You know, we have native stink bugs that look very similar. Stink bugs as a family is quite interesting because they're both plant feeders and predators in that group. But this one happens to be a plant-feeding one that can cause problems on tomatoes, peppers, apples. So there is somewhat of an agricultural pest. As the name implies, you pick one up, there's a very distinctive odor. They use that to defend themselves against predators and the like. The one thing I will say, no matter how many you find in your house, none of this is as staggering as when it first invaded in Pennsylvania, New Jersey. You know, I remember seeing the pictures of people literally filling up 5-gallon buckets of dead stink bugs on the outside of their house that were clustering. And we've had problems in the state, but nothing near of that level. And we're far enough down the road, it isn't going to happen at that number. But again, people don't like critters in the house. And as I said, unfortunately, like all those things, box elder bugs and like, we're past the point of stopping them from getting in. And so now whatever is in your walls, unfortunately, may cause a little bit of a minor nuisance from now well into next mid-April.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison's Department of Entomology. Great to have him back with us. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. If you had an experience or maybe you just got a question about an insect, curious about it, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking ahead to tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the legacy of the late guitarist and Wisconsin native Les Paul, and I know we're going to be playing a little Les Paul music in that first segment of our show, and then in the second part, we'll take a look at bluegrass music here in our state. We have some bluegrass singers that are going to be joining in on the show tomorrow, so we're looking forward to that as well. Right now, we're taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist. Great to have Phil back. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Pat, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but I've been just wondering, I've been looking at rodenticides that would kill like rats or mice and maybe chipmunks. And I'm thinking of the burying beetles that we have here. And sometimes they will find a dead animal and then bury it underground. And I think their offspring would eat that. My question would be, if that animal that died had died because of rodenticides, would the larvae be affected by that?
The insects, yeah.
Sure. It depends on the active ingredient. And I think most of the rodenticides, again, this is a little out of my area, but most of them are blood-thinning poisons for mammals. And because of that, insects in their system is so much different that I would not see a correlation there. Now, if it was something more akin to some of the true, you know, many of the insecticides also would kill rodents, then you can see that crossover. But as I said, generally the homeowner formulations are various forms of blood-thinning compounds, much like warfarin. I mean, literally warfarin has been used as a rodenticide, but there are newer chemicals. And as I said, the way they kill mammals and the rodents would not have an effect on insects.
Oh, Pat, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Victoria in Beaver Dam. Hi, Victoria.
Hi. I have a question about oak wilt. All of the oaks, all of the very old oaks that we have on the property, they all need to come down. We bought a piece of property about a year ago, and we really need to take all of the oaks out. But I'm curious to know if there's something that we can do to prevent any more of the oak wilt, or the seedlings that are starting that are about a foot and a half tall. Should we even take those out?
I would say no. Okay, so the thing about oak wilt, you know, different species of oak have different susceptibilities. Generally, the whites and burrs are far less susceptible. The reds and blacks are very susceptible. And there's a correlation with insects in that the sap beetles tend to root around in the decaying fungal mats on the tree, and they pick up the spores, and they're attracted to injured sites. And so this is one of the reasons that most municipalities have rules of not cutting oak during the growing season, because those wound sites will attract the beetles, and the beetles bring the spores, and the spores bring the disease. But once it gets in the tree, unfortunately, more of the transmission is root-to-root contact. And so that's why you see one tree gets infested, and then it's like a circle as it moves out. And that may have been why you lost so many trees. But if you look down the road, you know, as those roots decay and those young trees, I don't know if I've ever seen a small tree killed by oak wilt. And it's such an important tree in the landscape, wildlife and whatnot, I wouldn't worry about the seedlings and the like. If you've got a forester or whatnot helping you make some decisions on what to do with oak wilt, what needs to go, what not, there are different ways that they can trench or do other things to prevent the root transmission. And as I said, other than being careful when prune oaks, the ones that you do have, I think those are the best ways to defend yourself against further infestations.
Victoria, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Cheryl in Merrimack. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I'm wondering, I have gotten a service in to spray for spiders around the outside of my house, and they do like 5 applications from, you know, April through October. Is that legit, or is that really not doing too much?
It's legit, although my first reaction is 5 is way too many. The amount of spider problems you have sometimes relates to where you live. If you're close to a source of water and the like, your security lighting attracts all these critters to your house. And then, of course, that's spider food, and the spiders take advantage. So people who have docks and, again, cottages next to lakes have far more pressure with spiders than normal. And I think the norm, 2 times a year, once in the spring, once in the fall, would be reasonable. Some of this, again, is your personal concern about spiders. If they just, you can't sleep because you're concerned about spiders being around, then I understand treatments. But boy, 5 seems like an excessive amount. And the other thing to consider, again, is just thinking about, where's the problem? Is it light related? Can I change the kind of bulb that I've got so I still get security lighting but use a bulb that is less attractive to insects, which means less UV light? So there might be some adjustments you can have to kind of slow things up a little bit and the like. You know, if we lived in Florida where everything is just more intense, I can understand multiple applications, but it just seems like an awful lot for what we see in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Cheryl's in Merrimack, so she's certainly near water.
Right.
For sure. Cheryl, thank you for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Charlie in Birchwood, your turn. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, I was curious about the insect no-see-ums. I haven't heard about them since I was a kid, and just kind of curious on what happened to them.
Well, they're still around. No-see-ums are sand flies, or, you know, they're a small biting gnat. They are very weak flyers. And so usually you're going to have to go in the area they breed, and that's often around ponds, and we got this kind of marshy, mucky area. You know, one example to see them, we haven't seen a lot of problem with hemorrhagic disease in deer yet this year, but there have been some cases in that the deer pick up that virus from the bites of no-see-ums. And no-see-ums, typically when you get dry years, the deer tend to gravitate in the few places they find water, which is exactly where the no-see-ums breed. And so, we still see them. People call them sand fleas sometimes. Those are more typical, the ones that people run into down in Florida, and there is no such thing as a true sand flea. It's, again, these little gnats that bite. You don't feel the bite, but then you often react rather severely within a day or two. You know, itch for a week or so. They're really very unpleasant things. So there are still no-see-ums there, but as I said, if you're in an area that is not a likely breeding source, you might never see them. But if you get in the right spot, especially on a stiller day, because if the wind's blowing at all, even if you're in their own backyard, they can't fly strong enough flyers to get to you. So,
Charlie, thank you very much for calling. You mentioned this, excuse me, earlier, but a caller wanted to know who should be notified about sightings of worrisome insects.
Well, again, it kind of depends. If it's out in the woods, the DNR there are DNR foresters throughout the state. And as I said, you can take pictures. If it seems to be extensive enough, you can call to see if you can get somebody to come out to take a look. The Department of Ag also has some responsibilities as far as looking for invasive things, although they're more typically associated with growing crops in one sort or another and the like. It's always, samples, the extension office. If the local agent can't take care of it, as I said, there's both the insect diagnostic lab, the plant disease diagnostic lab, and the Department of Horticulture takes care of things too. So there are other resources you can get. I'm sure there are some county foresters that would be potentially available for some cases. It might take a little digging, but I think there are some people. If you see something that really looks afoul, said it might be just start with a phone call or start with an email with a picture to give them some idea what's going on and then go from there.
Doug in Onalaska has a question. Hi, Doug.
Hi. In my neighborhood, we have a lot of maple trees, and these particular maples drop their leaves later than the others. And it's a large leaf and yellowish gold color. What I've noticed is round black spots, or a big round black spot on each individual leaf, maybe the size of a quarter to a half dollar, 50 cent piece. And I'm wondering, it's a canker or a, I don't know what it is. And I'm wondering if your guest might have an idea what that is.
Yes, it's a fungus disease called tar spot. And tar spot can come and go a little bit depending, again, on spring moisture, like a lot of diseases. Quite common on Norway maple, which is not a native maple, but a very common street tree. In fact, I got one out in front of my house. It's not unusual for trees when they are heavily infested to drop their leaves early, but not necessarily. It really is cosmetic. I've never seen this cause the life or death of a tree. And as I said, it ebbs and flows depending on what kind of weather patterns we've got. You can argue that, cleaning up the leaves and disposing of them would lessen the amount of spores for the next year. But that in itself isn't going to solve the problem, just because there's always going to be a couple leaves somewhere that have it. But it sounds like classic tar spot to me.
Doug, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Phil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good, Larry.
Thanks a lot. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison in the Department of Entomology, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. So he's been out a while now. It's 10 years, my goodness. But he still comes back and is with us, and it's always fun. We're going to continue talking about insects. There's a new book out. It's a dandy. It's titled The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. And we'll talk with the author next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.